So would you define nocturnalization, please?
Well, nocturnalization is a term used by historians now to talk about how over the last, say, 300-400 years, so many activities have moved later and later in the 24-hour cycle. I mean, you know, when in the Middle Ages, when people were mostly peasants, you basically went to bed when the sun came down. You might sleep for 4 hours, get up for an hour, go back to sleep for 4 hours, but basically you were going to bed about, you know, 6 or 7 p.m. What happened since then is in the 1700s, 1800s, is all kinds of things, activities moved later into the evening. People used to have supper at, let's say, 4 p.m. They started having it at 6 or 7 or 8, or if you were a real scenester in Paris in the 19th century, you'd eat at 10 o'clock. People started going to bed later. Theaters were open later. And electric light and police forces in cities all made this possible. The question we ask now, I think, is this still going on? I mean, are we still staying out later and later, or is it pulled back, or is it kind of settled and stabilized? I mean, this remains to be seen.
Do you think that night shifts, that people working and not necessarily participating in nightlife as consumers, promotes nocturnalization?
Sometimes, if I try to think of a city in Canada or in Eastern or Central Canada where there are the most amenities available at night, I think not of Montreal, but I think actually of the city I'm from, Hamilton, Ontario. Now, Hamilton is not a city known for its nightlife, but it is a city where, because of its strong industrial base and because of the strong hospital sector, a lot of people work night shifts. This means that it's much easier to find a supermarket open 24 hours in Hamilton than in Montreal, the famous city of night. So I think we need to think of nighttime cities as those in which people work round the clock in areas other than culture and leisure and entertainment. And they often adapt to this with transportation, with retail amenities, with social services in ways that I think we could study.
To what extent are musicians and other members of the creative class also members of the service industry in this nightlife culture that's driven by consumption?
It's a very interesting question because on the one hand, we can say musicians and creative cultural workers are very much part of the service industry. First of all, they like members of the service industry, they're often underpaid. Their conditions of labor are often very precarious. And they are part of the amenities, if you like, that make people think a city is a good place to live. Of course, the difference is that creative and people and musicians in particular are seen as living the life of freedom, the freedom everyone else wants, whereas usually that is not at all the case for people in the traditional service industries like fast food restaurant workers, who are seen as perhaps the most constrained and oppressed of workers in our city. So it's an ambiguous relationship between cultural and non-cultural workers.
Let's talk about the service industry. I worked at a fast food restaurant, and I worked late. We weren't doing the all-night shift. We closed by about 2 a.m. usually. And one thing that I often wondered was, to what extent did our closing that late provide for a need? And to what extent did it create a need that we then served? I mean, do people really need to be eating junk food at midnight? Or is it just because the junk food is available that they feel compelled to do so?
My answer, I guess, would be that the need is there. Your being there, puts the possibility in people's mind. But I mean, as long as we've had a society since the 19th century where people live in cities, where they don't necessarily eat with their friends in their own home, where they're out driving around and so on, where there's greater mobility because of automobiles and technology, then I think we see the rise of these amenities like fast food places that are a response to changing social conditions. And, the need might be a little bit created, but I think it's a genuine need rooted in our ways of life.
So some of my interviewees have talked about a feeling they get when they're going to work to work their night shifts. I've spoken to a midwife and a medical resident, for example, who talk about a sort of dissonance with their surroundings as they're on their commute. And meanwhile, other people are either heading home or maybe going out to enjoy the nightlife that we've been discussing. I was wondering if you could speak to that from the standpoint of the different relationships that different demographics have to the 24-hour cycle and how sharing that resource of time is a matter of territory and perhaps conflict.
You know, there's sort of people who work in the night in the non-entertainment business or the non-sort of alcohol and say that it's very weird to spend most of your time, if you're in the hospital emergency room, for example, dealing with people who are drunk or who've had alcohol or in some way intoxicated or high or something like else. When you're not, this is your, you know, this is your bread and butter, your regular daily, nightly job, and so you're straight. And so if you're always confronting people who are in some kind of state of slightly altered reality, you really get a sense of two populations occupying the night. And I mean, police who work at night will say this too, bus drivers, and so on. So that's one thing. And you don't get this during the day. I mean, you know, whatever anyone's situation during the day is, they're usually not intoxicated in such large numbers or high or something like that. So I think that's the first difference. There's also the question that, you know, whether we like it or not, the people who go out and occupy nightclubs and things like that tend to be, they're not necessarily rich, but they tend to be middle class. The people who are doing the support work at night, selling them their kebabs and driving their taxis, tend to be lower class or lower middle class. And so you get these, not just conflicts or tensions of class, but judgments, you know, where you know, if you're watching kids who've had more advantages than you are, not particularly paying attention to the havoc they're causing, you can't help but make certain judgments. So I think there's that. At a more, I think, important social level, there's the idea of what the French geographer Luc Gudzinski calls the discontinuous citizenship that we can map around the 24-hour cycle. That is, for certain groups, young African-American youths in the United States, immigrant groups of color in Montreal, even if legally you have the same rights around the 24-hour cycle, there's a clear sense that if you're seen, you know, walking through a park in a gang at 1 a.m., you're going to be more immediately suspected of something and maybe even questioned and perhaps even incarcerated than, you know, than Piolaine Québécois or white Anglophones. And so your rights are technically the same, but in a kind of perceptual sense, you were seen as more of a problem. You are seen as not belonging there, as not occupying, possessing the same right to occupy that space. And this has always been the case for women. I think in countries like Canada and the U.S., and going back, you know, to the United Kingdom and so on, so much of the regulation of night or the moral sense we have at night is a response to the consumption of alcohol, which is why the temperance movement in the late 19th century resulted in strict closing laws. Bars could not be open too late. They couldn't be open on Sundays. This was all to protect families from drunken husbands and fathers and so on. And we forget how much of that rejection of alcohol shapes the way in which governments think of the night and how difficult it is to sort of pull all of that away and say, you know, maybe alcohol isn't the big, big problem and maybe we need to re-examine each one of these laws and rules and ask, really, do we need this anymore?
So you spoke of the discontinuous citizenship of the night. And I was wondering how that's connected perhaps to labor rights, the idea that you need to negotiate your rights in a different way during the night. And you also spoke about perhaps there's two, it could be perceived that there's two different populations. There's the people who are enjoying the night and the people who are working at night. How is that related to discontinuous citizenship?
I think there's a sense that much of the economic activity, for example, much more of it that goes on at night is somehow illegitimate or a little shady. I mean, if I go to the bay during the day, the bay department store, I know I can't go up to the counter and say, hey, do you have some cigarettes? Would you sell me an individual cigarette? Most people know that there are dépanneurs in Montreal they can go to at night and ask that kinds of question. And it's as a result of this that we tend to think of daytime economic activity as legitimate and nighttime activity as a little shady. And maybe it's not as well regulated, and maybe the people doing it are not sort of as bound to corporate right responsibility and so on. So over time, we get, you know, this very strong sense of a different morality at night versus the day. I always ask the question, you know, why can't you buy a refrigerator at 11 p.m.? But you can buy all kinds of other things. But you can buy all kinds of little things, and especially things that are kind of legal, kind of not, but like the sturdy, respectable things that you need for your daily life are not the things of the night. They're the things that you buy during the day at a store that belongs to an international chain and is not suspected of being shady. Now, having said this, of course, all kinds of crime and all kinds of shady activity goes on during the day. White-collar crime, it's called. Why don't we think of the day as a more evil and corrupt and morally suspect time? Well, we don't, but we think it's at night. It's the store that might be selling something out back, or the club owner who's probably dealing something under the counter, or has to make payoffs to Hell's Angels. And so as a result, we judge the world of day and the world of night from very different moral lenses.
And then as the law tries to regulate the urban night, what rights do citizens struggle for and want to maintain at night?
One of the things that you're really finding with the urban night now is that there's a fundamental clash that's quite new, even if elements of it have been around for a long time. And you find it in Paris and you find it in Montreal, which is that you have young couples moving back into inner cities. And they want to live in neighborhoods that are kind of funky and so on. But once they've got their condo and once they've got their first kid and the club downstairs is making too much noise and all everybody's going outside to smoke and the smoke's drifting up, they begin to feel that their right as homeowners or renters is being violated. The people who own the clubs will say, we are historically part of what makes this downtown neighborhood interesting and vital. These new colonizers moving in with their, you know, gentrifying habits are threatening our way of life. And, you know, in Montreal, we've seen this. In Paris, it's quite amazing now. Because you'll see bars with posters that say, contre la bistrophobie, against bistrophobia. Bistrophobia being the hatred of bistros. And that they're basically saying that you yuppies, gentrifiers moving in, you're bistrophobic. You hate bistros. We've been around. This is part of the historical character of the neighborhood. What did you think when you moved in? Of course, there's going to be noise and smoke. And then the bistrophobes, if you like, the gentrifiers are putting up posters saying, shh, people live here. This is a neighborhood. You bar owners are moving in and destroying the traditional village-type character of the neighborhood. And it's fascinating to watch. Both sides are claiming that they represent the traditional values of the neighborhood, and yet from very, very different opposed perspectives.